My name is Leif Arneson. I'm the founder of The Vegan Gym and host of The Vegan Gym Podcast. In this episode, I have the honor of interviewing the legendary Dr. Michael Greger. Dr. Greger is a physician, New York Times bestselling author, and founder of NutritionFacts.org, a science-based nonprofit organization dedicated to providing free nutrition education to the public. Join me and Dr. Greger as we explore his latest book, How Not to Age. I hope that you really enjoy our conversation. So, Dr. Greger, I just want to start by telling you that you've really inspired me in my health and fitness journey. I massively appreciate all of the work that you do at NutritionFacts.org, and I just wanted to start by thanking you for making the world a healthier, happier, and more compassionate place.
That's very sweet. It's the people that do it. I just put out the information. It's up to people to put it into place in their lives, but I'm so glad so many have.
Awesome. So I've been really looking forward to this interview, and I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me.
Sure,
so
totally.
Let's go ahead and dive in. So you've dedicated 3 years to researching and writing your latest book, How Not to Age, and you ended up with over 13,000 cited sources for the book. That's a heck of a lot of science to go through. One might expect that such a science-heavy book would be dry, but you wrote it in such a really enjoyable, easy, digestible way. And I also really appreciate your humor. I always kind of appreciate that sprinkled in. It makes it much more readable.
I wish there was more. I'm always looking for angles, but
I loved all the section titles.
I try my best. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I work hard on those.
You definitely did. So I'd love to hear what inspired you to take on this project.
You know, it was, remind me a lot of the diet book I did, How Not to Diet, where both the anti-aging and weight loss industries are these just like multi-billion dollar behemoths, right? Where there's just so much money in the mix that the temptation to, you know, promote all sorts of just preposterous garbage, right? Seems to just be, they just can't help themselves, right? It's really an educated layperson trying to do either living lighter or living longer is just bombarded by a barrage of pills and potions. And, yeah, I mean, even as a, you know, medical professional who has had the luxury of wading neck deep for years, in this information, the medical literature, even for me, it was difficult to separate out the naked truth from the emperor's clothing, basically. And so no one else would have a chance at, you know, separating fact from farce. And so the harder it was, the longer it got, the more I realized more important the endeavor was, because if it was taking me all this time, oh my God, well then one else has got a chance, right? I mean, I just have the luxury to be able to do that. And so it was really, there's just so much nutritional noise and nonsense out there. It's like the anti-aging field was just, there's just so much money to be made that there's this corrupting commercial influence, and very similar to the diet industry, right? I mean, so it's just like, you just, simple, basic questions, right? Should I take this supplement? Should I not? You're just lost. Like, it's just, you know, you can't know. Are they saying that because they believe it? Are they saying it because they're getting kickbacks? Are they, you know? Yeah. And so it's like, that's where I find my work most valuable, right? For something basic, uncontroversial, where there's just a consensus in the medical literature, you know, they don't need me, right? Particularly when there's competing interests, when there's a lot of money involved, particularly on one side, not the other, that's where it's like, well, maybe that's true, but, you know, they have this real competing interest for, you know, their stockholders that may be, you know, influencing their decision. And so that, you just got to go to the primary literature and you got to figure it out. And so, yeah, so this was, I mean, anti-aging literature is a mess. Just like the weight loss literature, a mess. And so it's like, here we go. Let's take it on.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, you definitely waded through your fair share of anti-aging literature. So Yeah, I'd love to jump right to the good stuff and ask you, from all the research that you did for this book, I presume there were tens of thousands of studies that you looked at beyond what was even cited in this book.
Sure.
What was your most fascinating discovery? What did you read that really kind of floored you?
Oh, my God, so much. I mean, I learn as much, almost as much as anybody else reading the book. Like, I mean, I didn't know any of this going into it. That's why I do the book. Yeah. I want to learn as much as anybody else does. And so, yeah, I went in with all sorts of preconceived notions that got dashed away. I thought I'd be promoting all sorts of supplements that I'd heard about, good things about, but most of them ended up being worse than useless. The exercise thing was wacky. The sleep thing was wacky. The NAD, the vitamin D, the on and on. There were entire fields of science that had not been discovered when I had graduated from medical school. I mean, so I have this whole chapter on microRNAs, which challenged the central dogma of biology, weren't discovered until after I graduated. So it's like I never even heard of these things. I mean, I'd run across it, but I mean, I didn't have any fundamental understanding. So I mean that I totally geeked out on that. I mean, it's just so much. I mean, you know. I'm trying to think. I mean, some of the stuff, like I'd done some Blue Zones work before, that wasn't much of a shock. But yeah, some of the aging pathways were, you know, new to me, like this, like, you know, the senescence, cellular senescence, the zombie cells and the senolytic compounds, all that stuff, totally new. So for me, that's the most interesting stuff. It may not be the most potent in terms of what you can actually do about it, or the most practical, or the most interesting for other people. But for me, you know, that was, you know, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the anti-aging pathways, I mean, people have heard about telomeres or something, but so many of the others, I think people are starting from total scratch. I had a little leg up on most of them, but some were new to me as well.
Yeah. I learned so much from reading this book, and it also challenged a lot of preconceived notions that I had, which was a real treat. So yeah, as you state in How Not to Age, only about 15 to 30% of our lifespan appears to be determined by our genes, which means how we live our lives is the main determinant in our lifespan. So after all the research that you've done, to what extent do you believe it's possible to slow down or even reverse aging with nutrition?
First of all, I just want to compliment you on what you just said, is that you said your preconceived notions challenged and you enjoyed it. Right? That's the right answer, yeah. Right? I mean, that is unfortunately, the opposite of how most people feel. They have these cherished beliefs, and it's like, you know, to rip them out of them, the people hate it, right? Yeah. They don't want to have their beliefs challenged. But that is the right mindset. Going in, you'd love someone to change your mind. It's such a thrill being like, oh my God, I was thinking this. And now, you know, logic, rationality, oh, new information. Now I'm over here. Anyone who isn't changing and doesn't enjoy it really doesn't belong in science. So anyway, I love that. That was beautiful. Okay. And so in terms of the genetic component, based on studies of identical twins, about 25% of the variation in lifespan between individuals is determined by genetics. But then it's like, okay, what can we do over the majority of which we may have some control over? Can we actually slow the rate of aging? Yes, and it's been put to the test. So there are studies, there's both observational studies, for example, where people eating a plant-based diet significantly slower rate of aging than their compatriots, adjusted for, you know, other lifestyle factors, and then put to the test in an interventional trial, which didn't make it into the book because it was published just August 2023, and, you know, the book was already written by then, was an interventional trial. They randomized people to a plant-based diet or exercise or neither, and found that the exercise did not actually slow the rate of aging, unfortunately, but the plant-based diet did. And so that was nice. You know, it was like, How Not to Diet, was, you know, I built this whole foundation, like this would be the optimal weight loss diet, and then came across the broad study, right? This New Zealand study, which showed that, oh, guess what? The exact diet that all the theory pointed to, this whole food plant-based diet, oh, showed the best weight loss 6 to 12 months compared to any other diet in the history of humanity in the peer-reviewed medical literature that didn't, you know, constrain calories or enforce exercise. So it's like, yeah, that's what should happen. And so there's the same kind of thing where it's like, okay, this is the diet that really should work. And then, they put it to the test. Bam, it worked. Nice.
Yeah, awesome. So you describe autophagy as both a salvage operation and garbage disposal in our body, picking up nutrients we need and clearing away the trash and debris. So what are the top things that you can do to turn on autophagy and promote longevity?
Yeah, so there's this internal kind of housekeeping process to get rid of the built-up cellular debris that may be contributing to the aging process. And so what you typically hear about autophagy, you typically think of fasting, right? That's why the big fasting promoters, the intermittent fasting, water-only fasting, why are they fasting? They'll talk to you about autophagy. And unfortunately, with the intermittent fasting, they're basing their timing on rodent studies. And so there's this thought that, like, even time-restricted feeding, like, you know, narrowing your daily feeding window to 12 hours or less every day, that somehow you're activating autophagy overnight. Like, if you, you know, skip a meal, you know, and you lengthen your fast between meals, you're going to activate autophagy. Works in rodents, 6 hours, bam. But they have such a metabolism. Literally, they're dead. They literally die within days of stopping eating. They can lose, you know, I forget, like 20% of their body weight, you know, in like 48-hour fast or something, which would take us like, you know, months. And so, unfortunately, in humans, to really ramp up autophagy, it's like 2 to 3 days fasting, a water-only fasting. And so that, I mean, that's just the poster child of unsustainable living, right? I mean, and it's really even too long to do on your own without medical supervision because it's critically important that your kidneys dive into sodium conservation mode when you fast, which should normally happen. And if it doesn't, though, you wouldn't know about it because the symptoms you have of so-called hyponatremia, decreased sodium in the brain, is just a little dizzy, a little lightheaded, just like normal fasting symptoms, and then you're dead. Then you have a seizure, drop, and crack your skull open. So we really shouldn't be, you know, fasting a long time without getting labs done and making sure that our kidneys are doing what they're supposed to be doing. Anyway, so we think of fasting, but it turns out, thankfully, there's all sorts of other ways that we can boost autophagy that don't involve, you know, starving for days at a time. This is one of those subtitles, you can fast or go fast. Exercise. So you can boost autophagy in the muscles by exercising. Although, unfortunately, it actually takes 60 minutes of, I believe it was just moderate intensity exercise, but 60 minutes, 20 minutes didn't work. So we got this data saying 60 minutes work, and you're like, ooh, maybe half an hour would work, maybe less would work. No. So we know 20 minutes doesn't. We know 60 minutes does, maybe 21 minutes does. You know, who knows? But we know, but it really does seem like you just can't, you know, half-ass it. If you really want to boost autophagy in the body, 60 minutes of at least moderate intensity physical activity. So that's exciting, right? And then there are some food components. One thing that actually definitely changed my diet was there's these autophagy activators. One of which my audiences are very happy about, is coffee. The chlorogenic acids, the primary antioxidant in coffee, activates autophagy and may explain why coffee drinkers, even though they tend to have all sorts of other like bad lifestyle behaviors, more smoking, etc., you can try to statistically adjust for that, but still coffee drinkers live longer than non-coffee drinkers, have lower rates of cancer. It's like a significant, like 3 cups of coffee, but it's like 13% lower all-cause mortality. That's significant. And it's like, what's going on? It turns out autophagy. Although, interestingly, some coffee has much more of these autophagy activators than not. Dairy milk actually binds up the chlorogenic acid, so you don't get the autophagy benefits. Starbucks roasts their beans so dark, actually destroys most of the chlorogenic acid. So anyway, so I just, that was fascinating. So it was a deep dive into coffee. And then spermidine, this longevity elixir spermidine, something I'm sure maybe I ran across it. Maybe not though. I mean, it was a pretty new concept. So, if you look at, I forget how many, I think hundreds of individual components of people's diets followed over years, the single dietary component most associated with longevity, or maybe even health and longevity, was spermidine. How much spermidine you're eating? You're like, what are you talking about? And so went back, how it was discovered, where it's found. And so, like, the most concentrated dietary source, wheat germ. So I'm adding wheat germ to my food. It wasn't before I learned this research. And so now, you know, I encourage people in the Daily Dozen to have a tablespoon of ground flaxseed every day. So what I do, since I want to have flaxseed throughout the day and I want to have wheat germ throughout the day, so I'm actually mixing half and half wheat germ, ground flax, and so then I just sprinkle that on whatever meal I happen to be eating. So I'm getting the flax, I'm in the wheat germ. Another reason I'm eating more tempeh, right? The number one source on a per weight basis per serving basis on a gram for gram basis. That's where the wheat germ comes in because the wheat germ serving is so small. So eating more tempeh, eating more mushrooms. In fact, I started growing my own mushrooms. You can grow oyster mushrooms just like you can grow, like you can make like broccoli sprouts and stuff on your windowsill. You can grow oyster mushrooms. How cool is that? And that's a whole nother thing, something called ergothionine, this so-called longevity vitamin, only found in fungi. Now, because the roots of plants interact with fungi underground, they can get a little bit in the plants, and then the animals can eat the plants and get a little bit. But, I mean, it's basically, there's nothing, if you don't eat some form of, you know, mushroom or tempeh, which is a kind of mushroom fermented, you know, soybean product, then you're missing out on this really apparently critical longevity vitamin, by which they mean it's not a vitamin in the sense that if you don't have it, you'll die. So it's not critical for life, but it's critical for a long, healthy life. And so if there was a baker's dozen of the Dr. Greger's Daily Dozen of all the things I encourage people to fit into their daily routine, if I had to add another one, I'd be adding mushrooms. And so because of the spermidine and the ergothionine, and so I have a whole long section about spermidine exactly. Oh, and so I think I actually have a target. Was it 24 milligrams? 20 milligrams. I think 20 milligrams, trying to hit a target of 20 milligrams of spermidine a day. And so you really have to like, you know, put some thought into, all right, well, I like this dish. So instead of making it with this, I'm going to, you know, like add tempeh, or I'm going to use green peas instead of this other vegetable. Or I'm going to, you know, use soy milk instead of this other milk because soy milk is the only one that really has a, you know, a good spermidine content. So just kind of go through and it's like, okay, well, I'm just, you know, it's just kind of something to think about. Now, I mean, I don't want people to get lost in the weeds, you know, and so like the conclusion of the book, I talk about, look, let's take a step back here. It's really the foundational, important, basic, simple lifestyle choices we make that really are, you know, the vast majority. So it's like regular exercise, eating more fruits and vegetables, not being obese, not smoking. That's like 80%, right? So it's like, if you just did that, forget the book, you're good. I mean, that's, you're doing great, way better than so many other people. That's like a decade of life right there. Boom, you just got 10 years, right? Okay, now, if you want to work on the 20%, I got 13,000 seconds. You know, then it's like, okay, let's add. So let's optimize, right? But I don't want people to be like, throw their hands up in the air and be like, what? I'm not going to add. Oh, forget it. I'm just going to eat my donuts, right? I'm just going to, you know, eat whatever crap the processed food industry puts in front of them. And so, you know, I'm always trying to you know, walk that line, like in Nutrition Facts. It's like, have videos on like, what's the healthiest apple? No one eats apples. Like, just eat an apple. I don't care. The healthiest apple is whatever apple you'll put in your mouth, right? But the video is not for that. And that really where the video should be, the general public that's not eating apples. But it's like, this is the video where it's like, okay, you like apples. You're eating apples. Well, I mean, if you're gonna eat an apple and you really don't care which one you eat, you might as well eat the one that's healthier than the other ones, right? Okay, so I have a video. But it's just like, give me a break. And so people have you know, kind of made fun of me for my, like, this is the best lentil or the best bean. Okay, no, totally taken. You're right. Just eat your lentils and shut up. But I don't know. I'm curious. I know how lentils are good for me, so I'm going to eat the lentils. So if I'm going to eat lentils and I'm online buying lentils and I got choices, they're all pretty much the same price. So, you know, I'm curious. I want to know. Other people are curious too, but, you know, it's like, how much of my work should be targeted toward the tweakers, you know, the optimizers, versus like, oh, come on, people, would you just eat, you know, please eat a sweet potato. Just, that's it. You know, and then I'm like, eat a purple sweet potato. And then, you know, but okay. Anyway.
Yeah, that's I'm definitely in the optimizing the 20% kind of category, but that's a really important point. And I honestly don't like mushrooms, but your book really has worked to change my mind on that.
What about tempeh? Can you do tempeh? Are you not a tempeh fan?
I pretty much just eat tofu, but need to, based on reading the book,
Try the tempeh, right?
Both of those are things that I need to start including.
And there's, I'm trying to think of some, I know, like even porcinis, man, porcini is so good. Have you tried porcinis?
I don't think so.
Okay, no. You have not had a mushroom, so you've had a porcini mushroom.
Okay, you can get them dried. The first to try?
You can get them dried. You can get them dried. And I don't know if it's like the texture or what it is about. Some people just don't like mushrooms. I know my mom. My mom says she doesn't like mushrooms. She's never tried a mushroom because they just oogie her out or whatever. I'm like, you can't say you don't like mushrooms if you've never tasted a mushroom. So, okay. So, but anyway, just in terms of flavor. So you could just like, in fact, I think you can get porcini powder, like dried porcini mushroom powder. It just has this really incredible umami broth. It's just like, oh my God, I cannot have a pasta sauce without some porcini flavor. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to need to figure out how to sneak those into my diet. So nice. I'll work on that.
Nice.
And I guess one more strike that I'll add to that list is coffee. I don't drink coffee.
Okay.
And I was actually really surprised at how beneficial coffee appears to be based on the research in your book. So as you touched on, coffee drinkers will be thrilled to know that coffee enhances autophagy. Coffee drinking has also been tied with higher physical performance and a greater muscle mass index. In fact, you cite a study in your book, a 2014 study where young people drank 3 cups of coffee per day for a month and their fat-free mass index increased by about 1 pound while their fat mass dropped 1 to 2 pounds, which was really incredible. So should...
Compared to not drinking coffee or drinking something else, you remember?
I just don't
be curious anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
But, should non-coffee drinkers learn to like coffee?
Green tea. So, every cup of coffee has an opportunity cost. It's a lost opportunity to drink something even healthier. Green tea. So I talked about 3 cups of coffee, 13% decrease in all cause mortality. Right, so you do a study over 10 years and a certain number of people die, and so you have a risk of whatever dying is 13% lower among the coffee drinkers than among those non-coffee drinkers. Okay, 23% lower among green tea drinkers, right, with the same kind of adjustments for other lifestyle factors. So drink green tea. Now, if you say you don't like green tea, then we got to work on something else. But
I do like green tea. So.
Boom, boom.
I'll get one little check.
Totally all set. Now, so it's not helping you in the autophagy section. Green tea has this hormetic effect, all sorts of other, so it benefits you in other ways. So one could imagine how coffee and green tea could complement one another. But if you're just talking about autophagy activation, you know, the wheat germ, there's other things that can activate autophagy that aren't coffee. And decaf works just as well if caffeine's the problem. The reason you don't like coffee.
All right, mushrooms, green tea. I'm working on it.
Great.
So you referenced zombie cells earlier.
Zombie
cells? And how are they eating us alive?
Fascinating topic. Just a real fascinating topic. So I talk about the Hayflick limit, which is cells only divide a certain number of times. And then they stop dividing. We used to think that cells just divide forever, right? You put a cell and it makes 2 cells, and 2 cells make 4 cells, blah, 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 blah. Oh, no, and all of a sudden they stop. What happened? It's good because the body's trying to protect you from cancer. So there's a natural limit on how many cell times your cells can divide. Okay. So this is a cell becoming senescent. It is its ability to replicate goes away. And so what the cell does is it releases these inflammatory compounds into the system to signal to the immune system, I'm done, take me away. I'm useless, you know, cart me away okay. And so, that's what, you know, inflammation is. You get a splinter, right? It pulls the immune system in. That's the redness and the swelling and the, you know, heat. It's bringing the immune system to it. And so this, spews out this inflammatory signals as a signal to clear to dispose of itself. Okay, so that's fine, great. Okay, unfortunately, the ability of our immune system to clear senescent cells declines as we age. And so we have these cells spewing out inflammation, but they're not being picked up. So they just keep spewing out inflammation, and inflammation plays a role in the aging process. These cells are so toxic. So these are these zombie cells, right? Because they're like dead, quote unquote, not really dead, but they're just actively damaging the surrounding tissues because your body's just not as good at getting rid of it anymore. And you can do these experiments where you take a few senolytic cells. These are mostly done laboratory animal experiments. You take a few senolytic cells, inject it into a young animal, and you can have all these terrible things happen to it. And it's just like, well, it's just a few cells. It just shows how powerful just a few cells. I mean, you wouldn't think that would have much a big difference. And so anyway, so the anti-aging industry and big pharma in general is trying to find these so-called senolytic drugs. Drugs that go and kill these senescent cells and clear them out of the body, which is supposed to be happening naturally. Now, the emphasis that I have in the book really is on preventing cells from prematurely going senescent in the first place. There is a natural limit to cell life, but DNA damage can prematurely force the cell into senescence, which makes sense. Why? Because senescence is an anti-cancer mechanism, right? And so if your DNA is getting mutated, well, then you don't want the cell to still, you know, divide 10 more times and stop. You want it to stop right in its tracks. With increased DNA damage, typically caused by free radicals, which can be caused by radiation, can be caused by foods we eat, smoking, all sorts of bad things in our environment. So all of a sudden, you know, we're supposed to just have one or two, senescent cells, and all of a sudden we have senescent cells left and right. And so that's really the primary. And so then it really goes to the kind of oxidation chapter, where it talks about, you know, how can we bathe our bodies in antioxidants all day long? And that's where green tea comes in, which actually is a pro-oxidant. So cool. It's the hormesis, you know, that which doesn't kill us makes us stronger. The hormesis, so the green tea, the body sees it as dangerous and so ramps up its antioxidant defenses, ramps up our antioxidant enzymes. And so we are at this higher level of antioxidant status because of this actual small pro-inflammatory insult. Same thing happens with marathon runners. Marathon runners, the day of the marathon, they get a hit to their DNA. The amount of cells, you can take a blood sample, amount of white blood cells with DNA damage ramps up because there's a lot of oxidative damage with that heavy exertion. But you go back a week later and they end up with lower DNA damage than when they started before the marathon. Why? Because they so ramped up their DNA repair mechanisms that all of a sudden they're doing better than when they were doing before. Same thing happens with green tea. Same thing happens with broccoli. Broccoli revs up your detox enzymes. And so, you know, if you're going to get less of a caffeine buzz from your green tea if you eat some broccoli because it so detoxifies everything. Why? Because your body sees broccoli as a threat. It was like, oh my God, we got to get these detox enzymes. But has this been? So, but it turns out it's not a threat. It kind of fools the body into thinking it is. And then it mounts this big response. And so you're walking around, if you're eating cruciferous vegetables, you're walking out on high alert, high DNA repair, high detox enzymes, all that good stuff. Anyway, so that's how we prevent ourselves from becoming prematurely senescent. But then I do talk about how there is new exciting research about food compounds that have senolytic effects. Unfortunately, these senolytic effects are in vitro or in animal models. We have yet to test these food compounds in people. So what are these food compounds? So one is fisetin, found really concentrated only one place, not just one food category, one food, strawberries. So if I'm putting a berry on my oatmeal, I'd usually use blackberries, 5 times more antioxidants than strawberries, right? So like, you know, I like them both. I might as well choose the one that's 5 times more antioxidants. Little did I know about fisetin, where there's probably not any in blackberries or very little, whereas, you know, strawberries are like the most concentrated dietary source. Okay, damn, okay, well, now so we should eat fresh, frozen, freeze-dried strawberries. In fact, on my bag, I have a little packets of freeze-dried strawberry powder on the road. I can dump in, you know, some hotel oatmeal or something. And so I'm eating more strawberries. And that's because of this book, because, fisetin is a senolytic compound. Can you raise the levels of fisetin in your bloodstream enough eating just regular doses of strawberries to actually have a senolytic effect? We don't know. Hasn't been tested. So that's kind of a more of a theoretical thing, but it's like, look, strawberry. Then I go through all the studies showing strawberries have these amazing effects. You know, like use strawberries to treat osteoarthritis, and these remarkable benefits. The strawberries, like, maybe it's that makes sense if it's the fisetin, right? So anyway, that's one of the things I've added. Another thing, piperlongamine, which is this senolytic compound found in long pepper, or something called papali, which you can find in Indian spice stores. Something else I've added to my daily diet as a senolytic compound. Another one is quercetin, which is found concentrated in kale, onions, tea, and capers. So I'm eating capers. I never ate capers before. Yep. It's hard to find low-salt capers, but, you know, it's something I wanted to add because it's a good source of quercetin. So the combination of decreasing DNA damage and then to help clear the body from senescent cells, these three senolytic compounds. And so there's just various foods that are most concentrated sources.
Awesome. You say in the book that being just 11 pounds overweight lowers your life expectancy by 30 minutes per day. I was astounded when I saw that, which is the same amount as smoking 2 cigarettes or drinking 2 pints of beer per day. So why does being even slightly overweight have such a huge negative impact on your lifespan?
Yeah, that's the most dangerous fat. We think that the superficial jiggly fat under the skin is metabolically benign. We know that because we can do these massive liposuctions on people where we take away, you know, dozens of pounds of fat and see no benefit in terms of metabolic. And if we had lost dozens of pounds, you know, using diet or exercise, we'd have all sorts of tremendous metabolic benefits. So it's the visceral fat. It's this deep belly fat below our abdominal musculature that kind of bulges out our belly that infiltrates and wraps around our internal organs. So the fat inside of our liver is visceral fat. And it's that fat that spews inflammation into the bloodstream, has a pro-inflammatory effect, increases triglycerides, increases the cholesterol. Thankfully, the body realizes that's the most dangerous fat, and that's the first fat you lose. So when you're actually losing weight, your body preferentially, so people look in the mirror and they see all this jiggly external fat, and you're like, I've been exercising, I'm losing weight, it looks the same. Well, no, your body's got some priorities, right? Your body's getting rid of the worst fat first. And so we think it's the visceral fat. So whatever component of that 11 pounds is visceral fat, that's the really dangerous stuff that we can get rid of.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really important point and, something that most people don't know about.
And so it doesn't take much, right? I mean, that's the exciting thing. So, right. You know, in the caloric restriction study, I talk about the calorie studies, the biggest, I mean, by far, there's really no study in caloric restriction that comes close. You know, it was 12%, ended up being 12% calorie restricted, which is like skipping a piece of pie or something every day. Not a lot. And so all this tremendous range of benefits. But they started out with people with normal weight. And normal weight in the United States is overweight. And so they were like, you know, 26, 27 BMI. And so, duh, overweight people losing weight, I have all these benefits, big duh. But it was very frustrating to the calorie restriction people being like, yeah, no, no, I want to know if I'm ideal weight and I restrict 12%, can I get benefits? And we don't know that because we just, we don't have that, the science, the human science at least. But for me, I'm like, no, this is really important. This is, right? This should tell, because this is applies, you can extrapolate this to most of the population, showing 12% cut in calories. Like, you know, again, just that is not many calories. And you get this broad range of benefits. This is over 2 year time. But, and so it's like, wow, you know, you don't have to have this like, well, if I can't lose 100 pounds, well then it's useless. No, I mean, using, you know, just, you know, 5%, 10% of your body weight, if you have excess body fat, can have these tremendous metabolic benefits.
Yeah, awesome. So you stated in your book that AMPK is considered to be one of the most important breakthroughs in biomedicine in the last few decades and is one of the top pathways to longevity. You described it as having the potential to be, quote, exercise in a pill. What do you mean by that, and how can we harness the power of AMPK?
Yeah, so yeah, it's an exercise mimetic, and it's also a calorie restriction mimetic. So it's like, how do you, you know, how do you get the benefits of exercise and calorie restriction without the sweat, without the hunger? Well, that big pharma, that was the big dream, right? And so, yeah, AMPK. So I first did a deep dive into AMPK in the diet book, right? Because it's known as the fat controller. So it's this enzyme that is basically like a fuel gauge in the body. So the universal currency of energy in biology, all biology, is ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and it's these high powered phosphates that get split off and do whatever the body wants to do, lift a muscle or whatever. And then it goes down to AMP, adenosine monophosphate. We only have one phosphate. And then we charge it back up with two extra phosphates. Plants do it through photosynthesis with the sun. We do it by eating, you know, protein, carbs, fat. And then so it's like we're like a rechargeable battery all the time. We're you know, and so, and there's a ratio, I think it's like 100 AMP to 1 ATP or whatever. And so there's just a balance where we got to maintain that balance in AMPK. Is an indicator of that, you know, we're getting close to the empty. And so no wonder that, I mean, that's so it controls fat stores, boosted by exercise, obviously, right? I mean, that's how do you deplete energy? Well, you can fast, that'll boost AMPK, or you can expend energy through exercise, and you'll get a boost in AMPK. So it's this kind of anti-aging hormone that can be, and there's also some dietary interventions like vinegar. So vinegar to for the acetic acid, which is what defines vinegar, to metabolize in the body, actually uses energy, and so you get this boost in AMPK. So it's neat that there's things we can do about it. I think there's some other things, barberries, we've kind of undergone a renaissance with the whole GLP-1 agonist. Because of this berberine compound in barberries. Delicious stuff. Is that something you've tried?
I mean, it's just these I have not.
Little dry berries. So you go to a Middle Eastern store and you get these little barberries. They, you know, it's a really nice flavor. And so it's the kind of thing, it's great when I find things that it's like, wow, I would eat this even if it wasn't, not if it wasn't healthy, but if it was just like neutral, it didn't have any particular benefits. It's like, wow, I just like it because it tastes good. And that's the same thing with barberries. So like eating a salad without barberries, useless. I mean, it's not useless. I mean, it just doesn't taste as good. Like, it has this really great tart little bite to it. And so, yeah, super healthy. And one of which is because of AMPK activation. There's some other, a few other things. Maybe black cumin. I forget that. It's a long book. But there's some things we can do in our diet in addition to exercise that can boost AMPK.
Yeah, awesome. Seems like with all these small little food additions that we need to add to our diet, you should have like the Dr. Greger meal subscription or something where you're sending a monthly box,
right,
or something.
Right. Well, there are a few companies.
I know Leafside, yeah.
So Leafside is one. There's another one called Whole something. forget the name, but they're also doing this kind of daily dozen thing. They're doing like a weight loss thing where they're going to incorporate some of these spices and stuff like that. Yeah, cool. In fact, my next book, I was just thinking about my next book, which is going to be on cancer, a cancer survival. And I'm thinking of doing kind of like a, you know, a protocol for every single major cancer.
Oh, wow.
Or at least, I don't know, top 20, 30 cancers. And it's like, well, this is what I would, you know, recommend for, you know, ovarian cancer. This is everything that's ever been shown to like improve prognosis, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and with the levels of evidence, some, we have great evidence. We have interventional trials that can actually help, things that can actually help. But other things are just observational evidence. You know, people that, you know, people with lung cancer who eat more broccoli tend to live longer than those that don't. But it's like, well, yeah, but broccoli eaters probably exercise more, do other stuff. You can try to, you know, it's confounding factors. It's difficult to tease out. But just as long, I feel comfortable with that kind of protocol approach, as long as I'm very transparent, be like, this is the level of evidence. And in fact, if you don't have to do all these things, here's the, like the type A evidence or whatever, this is the best evidence. And then this, well, you know, we're not sure. And then this is like, well, look, it works in mice. You know, you put, you know, human, you know, breast cancer cells in mice, they get a tumor, and then you give them this food and the tumor shrinks. Who, you know, you're not a mouse. Who knows if it's good, but look, you know, just wanted you to know if that's, if that motivates you, convinces you, whatever. I just wanted to have it on the thing because it helped in some way. And so I can totally see some company being like, this is the Gregor ovarian cancer protocol in a pill or in a meal thing or whatever. And I would welcome that. I mean, totally. I mean, I would never accept money from them or, well, I'd promote them as long as they didn't give me any money. I mean, if they're helping people, I'm all for, you know, as long as there's no kind of, you know, quid pro quo.
Yeah. Awesome. So you made a bold statement in your book about sodium. You said excess sodium appears to be humanity's number one dietary risk factor for death. So I work out a lot. I sweat a lot. I often crave salt, and I'm not sure how much of that craving is actually necessary versus just something that I want to eat.
And I know, exactly.
I right. know a lot of athletes feel right. similarly. What is a good way to determine your required sodium intake?
So I would stick to the American Heart Association's 1500 milligrams a day. In fact, I'm going to do a series of videos on just that question because I get that question a lot. And so, in fact, I just went and did a deep dive and pulled all the articles and haven't read them all yet. So who knows? I mean, but my impression is that no one ever needs to supplement with salt. That you really, we think we lose more salt than we actually do, and we can get it all from food and blah, blah, blah. But don't take my word for that until I do the videos and actually am an expert on the topic instead of just having read some abstracts. But in general public, definitely 1500 milligrams as a maximum. And so, yeah, I would not go out of the way unless your doctor tells you eat salt for, I mean, there's sodium wasting conditions, kidney problems that you know. But yeah, people should be, in fact, replacing salt with either salt-free seasonings. And there's lots out there. That porcini, nice flavor without the salt. And if you do have good healthy kidneys, potassium chloride. So move it from sodium salt to potassium salt. That's what I use. And could just save millions of lives, but you know, it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have not tried it yet, but I've been looking. I think one of the products is New Salt, and there are a few other ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, they're pretty much the same.
That's good to know that you use that.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about olive oil. So a few months ago, I came across a guy named Brian Johnson, and he spent the past few years working to extend his lifespan to the greatest extent possible using today's leading science and technology. I know Dr. Khan mentioned him to you in a recent interview. I'm not sure if you've done more research into him, but the reason I'm bringing up Brian is that he eats 2 tablespoons of olive oil per day, which accounts for over 10% of his strict daily calorie intake. He eats that for its polyphenols. What is your take on olive oil with respect to longevity?
I'm all for polyphenols, right? Because of these the highlight of my postbiotics chapter, the fact that, you know, these polyphenols are good gut bugs, turn them into all sorts of fancy stuff, although it depends not only on eating those polyphenols, but having the requisite microbial machinery. And so that's a whole different thing. If you just wipe them out with an antibiotic, you can eat all the whatever, and you're not going to make the postbiotic we want. But, I mean, olives are a plant food. Now, when you extract out the oil, what you're doing is the olive wastewater is you're throwing away all the water-soluble compounds, right? So, yeah, you get all the fat-soluble compounds, which is fantastic, but you're losing out on the rest. And so you're like, well, so normally you'd be like, well, why don't we do this with the whole food? It's like if you take a walnut and you extract walnut oil, it's a little vitamin E and some fat-soluble compounds, but you just threw out all the fiber, you threw out all the, you know, all that other good stuff, threw out the minerals. So why would you do that, right? Okay. Probably can't do that with olives because the brining process adds so much sodium. So there has to be a way to brine olives. I don't know. I don't know anything about olive processing. There has to be a way to make olives palatable without so much sodium. I remember I was in Greece, and there's an olive tree. I was like, this is amazing. It's like having an avocado tree. Like, I love olives. So, like, I just plucked an olive, and they got to be brined. Let me just tell you, they got to be. You just can't. Whoever first brined the first olive, because they're just so inedible, just, like, as fruit. Anyway, but there's got to be a way. I'm a big fan of his work. I mean, I looked at it just basically, I'm like, what does he eat? Because that's all that, like, really is, like, because that's what I know him the most about. So if he, you know, he says he lives off, you know, bacon and butter all day, it's just like, I'm not going to listen to him for any of his recommendations because he's just so far on some flat earth theory, you know. But no, he's a strictly plant-based diet. I'm like, okay, at least this guy, like, knows what he's talking about. And the fact that you can see differences in health, randomizing people to extra virgin olive oil versus regular olive oil, the fact that you can actually see a difference shows those olive polyphenols are actually doing good things. And the question is, well, could we get those good things from whole foods? And that's what my goal is. But I mean, that was the PrettyMed study. It's not that they imagine that they're feeding people all this olive oil. No, they were already eating olive oil. They just switched them to extra virgin olive oil, saw all these benefits. Well, there's really only the only difference between those two is there's more polyphenols in the first pressing than later on in the process. So, I mean, there's beneficial effects, but can we get those beneficial effects in a less, you know, calorie concentrated form, 120 calories? It's like hard to imagine you couldn't get a better nutrient per calorie ratio. Like, you want like polyphenols per calorie. Now, you wouldn't be getting necessarily those olive polyphenols, but it's like, you know, oil is the most calorie concentrated food on the planet, right? Even butter has a little water in it, so it doesn't have as many calories. And so now in his case, he's not worried about that, right? I mean, so the reason we don't want people drinking oil is just because it's so many calories, so little nutrition typically, that it's just like it's going to contribute to the obesity epidemic. But he's like, you know, he's got it dialed in. Yeah. So that's my primary concern that it's just all these kind of empty calories. Well, you know, he kind of sidesteps that. But I'm afraid people see that and be like, oh, the guy's done the research. Longevity is about chugging olive oil. You know, I'm sure even he would be like, that's not how I do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, actually, the first I ever saw of him was a reel of him taking like 112 pills in a day.
Oh, Jesus.
Like all his supplements.
Wow. Oh, so yeah, and I didn't look at his supplement regimen. That would be fascinating to me.
It's his supplement regimen is pretty interesting. But anyways, I first saw that and just totally discounted it. I thought this guy's a complete whack job. And then I started doing some more research. I saw a longer video with him, and I really loved his diet breakdown. And he's vegan. He doesn't really, he doesn't push that hard, but he talks about plant-based and he says, that's what I eat. So yeah, I think he's definitely got dialed in, but I had the same thoughts
about
olives.
I could not think of 120 supplements that I could possibly imagine be beneficial. I'd be curious to look at the list. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he has it on his website. So
yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. It's just, yeah.
So you say, One of the section titles in your book is low-carb diets are low lifespan diets, and low-carb diets have a 22% increase in overall mortality risk. I would absolutely love to hear Dr. Greger's low-carb takedown. So what would you say in response to someone who says a low-carb diet like keto is healthy? We see it all the time on our comments, people coming and posting that. So what's your 1 minute
eviscerate? You just did it. What I mean, it increases all-cause mortality unless you're suicidal. Like, what? I mean, it can help with intractable pediatric epilepsy. I mean, there's like certain kind of medical cases where ketogenic diets can be useful when drugs don't work. But I don't know. I've got lots of videos about it. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, any diet that tells people don't eat fruit, for example, I mean, it's just like already right there. Like, that's all you have to know about a diet. Like, oh, don't eat fruit? Really? Like or don't eat whole grains or don't eat legumes. I mean, any diet that says that. So Goldberg disease study, the largest study of human risk factors in history, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The number one thing we can do to improve lifespan, associated with lifespan, eat legumes. Number two is whole grains. Number three is fruit. Number four is reduced meat. Number five is reduced, you know, sugary drinks. So three of the top five are actually things we're not doing enough of, not getting enough of. And so it's like, look, so, I mean, it doesn't even make sense. So anyone saying don't eat any of those foods, it's like, well, that's the opposite of what a longevity diet is. So, you know, and, you know, even if it did have long-term sustainable weight loss, which is debatable at best, the goal of weight loss is not to fit into a skinnier casket. The goal of weight loss is to not make it lighter for your pallbearers, right?
Yeah, well said. So How Not to Age features Dr. Greger's anti-aging eight, which are eight things you recommend for lifespan extension. Nuts is the first one featured, and you say that nothing beats nuts for reducing the associated risk of dying before one's time. So why are nuts so beneficial, and what type of nuts should we be eating?
Yeah, certainly on a gram-for-gram basis. So maybe on a per serving basis, maybe legumes, but yeah, nuts on a, because the a nut serving is only an ounce. Yeah, there's nothing associated with a longer lifespan than nut consumption. I talk about the various benefits of different organ systems. I remember ending up saying, you know, walnuts. I mean, so normally I'd be like, whatever nut you'll eat is the best nut, right? Whatever vegetable you eat, the best, blah, blah, blah. But no, walnuts really do seem to kind of edge ahead of the other nuts. Only nuts really been shown to improve, acutely improve artery function. Highest omega-3s, highest antioxidants of other nuts. So I would really, you know, it's rare that I kind of would single out, you know, be that granular. But yeah, so handful of walnuts every day. I'm sure the big walnut is very happy with my whatever. But these studies showing, you know, remarkable associations with decreased all-cause mortality were a variety of nuts. But walnuts really do seem to kind of pull ahead. Peanut butter doesn't count, apparently. And you can overdo nuts. So you do not want to eat more than a cup of nuts a day. I mean, it's kind of hard to do. But because of the oxalates, you can actually increase your risk of oxalate kidney stones. Just like you shouldn't eat too many star fruit or really eat any star fruit. Really, you've got to watch chaga mushrooms and not eat cups, plural, of spinach, beet greens, or Swiss chard a day. Again, because the kidney stone issue.
Yeah, and a cup of nuts is also going to pack quite a calorie punch.
Oh, so that's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot of calories. Yeah, that's why I don't think typically, and they're so, yeah. But, you know, some people, you know, that's like their snack. So instead of eating popcorn, like they're sitting watching Netflix, they're just like have a huge bag of like cashews or something, and they're getting huge amounts of calories. But that's a kind of scenario where it's this mindless eating. Like you don't even, you're not even enjoying it. Like, come on, if you're going to get all those calories, at least enjoy the calories.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just kind of, and then the bag's done and you're like, well, what just happened? You can imagine then you'd run into it. Now you still have to have a predisposition to kidney stones. But you know, you don't know if you're in that category or not. So I wouldn't overdo it.
Yeah. So let's talk about protein. Insulin-like growth factor 1, IGF-1, is one of the key signals that regulates cell growth and is one of the 11 pathways of aging that you identify in your book. At a basic level, the higher your levels of IGF-1, the shorter you live. Fasting can naturally reduce IGF-1 levels, but a more sustainable approach is protein restriction. So why does protein restriction, specifically animal protein restriction, improve our lifespans?
So the reason why fasting decreases IGF-1 is because you're restricting protein. If you don't restrict protein and just dramatically cut your calories, it doesn't work. So members of the Calorie Restriction Society, the so-called cronies, that, you know, that make it part of their life to do, like, serious calorie restriction, actually, their IGF-1 levels, exact same as the general population, because they're eating these high-protein diets. Whereas they actually did a nice interventional study, be like, is it the protein? Okay, well, let's randomize people to lower protein, and boom, drop like a rock. And so, now, in laboratory animals, it's different. Laboratory animals, just cutting calories drops IGF-1. Does not happen in humans. But, I mean, it's easier, right, to cut down on protein than it is to cut down on everything. And now, at moderate protein intakes, animal protein increases IGF-1, whereas plant protein does not. At excessive protein intakes, doesn't matter. Either way, plant protein or animal protein is going to bump your IGF-1 up. Only when you get down to kind of moderate intakes does it matter what kind of protein when it comes to IGF-1. So if you're trying to IGF-1, which is not just pro-aging, but pro-cancer, cancer kind of accelerating enzyme for a variety of cancers, not all cancers. We want to keep IGF-1. In fact, these longevity syndromes, many of these famous longevity syndromes, these genetic, you know, these families that have these, you know, crazy longevity syndromes, it comes down to an IGF-1. So Ashkenazi Jews, for example, which is my heritage, a defective IGF-1 receptor. So you have actually high IGF-1 because your receptors don't work, so your body's trying to pump it out. But just the IGF-1 signaling is down. There's a Laurent syndrome, where it's this form of dwarfism, where they have, from birth, they don't make enough IGF-1, and so they don't grow. They grow to a very short stature, but they're like immune from cancer, practically, right? So the goal is, okay, let's get enough IGF-1 to reach adult stature, adult height, and then do everything we can to downregulate. Once we've kind of maxed out, then we want to downregulate IGF-1 to reduce our risk of cancer. Now, the thought is, well, wait a second. Yeah, there's more to growth than height. What about people who are trying to bulk up muscle, right? And so don't we want that extra IGF-1 signaling? In fact, IGF-1 is used as kind of, you know, the thought is it has some kind of anabolic properties. So might there be this kind of teeter-totter, the seesaw, where it's like, well, you know, if you want to cut down on cancer risk, you're going to, you know, lose some of your ability to bulk up muscle. That does not seem to be the case. And there's a variety of lines of evidence that I talk about in the book. One is people with this form of giantism, like Andre the Giant. That's actually a IGF-1 syndrome of accelerated IGF-1. They don't have, well, Andre is a bad example because he actually bulked up. People with these a particular form of giantism caused by IGF-1 actually don't have more muscle than per capita, you know, based on their weight, than other people. And there's actually an interventional study on women. They actually injected women with IGF-1 during or placebo during a resistance exercise regimen, saw no benefit in terms of muscle mass accretion. Now, you could argue maybe it works in men, doesn't work in women. That's never been tried. But, I mean, I can't imagine how there'd be that gender differential. So it doesn't appear that we suffer kind of any downsides of having low IGF-1. So we really should try to drop it. How do we drop it? We can drop it by reducing protein intake down to recommended levels and switching to animal protein from plant protein. Excuse me, switch to plant protein from animal protein.
Yeah. So kind of going off of that with protein restriction and then also focusing on plant protein and swapping out animal sources, let's talk a little bit about FGF21. So the main reason often cited for why plant protein sources are preferable to animal sources is that food is a package deal, and animal protein sources are prepackaged with saturated fat, cholesterol, all these other bad things that we want to avoid. But a new human hormone discovered in the year 2000 presents a reason why plant protein may itself actually be healthier. So what is FGF21? What are its benefits and how do we boost it?
Yeah, FGF21 is very cool. That's another thing that I had no idea. I probably actually had never heard of it before. And it's this pro-longevity hormone that can be boosted through fasting, can be boosted through protein restriction. And so there's a whole section in the book where I talk about it, and really that was very compelling. But that's not the only. So it's not just IGF. It's not just like, oh, protein restriction for the IGF-1, not just for the FGF21, but also for probably the most persuasive, aging pathway, and that's mTOR. So mTOR, and the reason I say that, it's probably a controversial statement, but the reason I say that is because rapamycin, the drug that blocks mTOR, is a universal anti-aging drug. Nothing else. There's no other thing that's ever been found. Every single species ever tested, you extend the lifespan with rapamycin. No other drug does that. No other anything does that, right? And so the fact that it makes a universal, blocking this pathway universally extends life. Wow. Okay. Now we're serious. And so mTOR is this age accelerating enzyme. And how do we reduce it? Protein restriction. And by protein restriction, I'm talking about reducing protein down to recommended levels, not below. I mean, so you can get protein deficient, from excess levels down to recommended levels. And so we're talking about 0.8 grams per healthy kilogram body weight a day. It's about 45 grams for the average height woman, about 55 grams for the average height man. Or for those who don't like metric, it's like 0.36 grams per pound of ideal body weight. So you find out what your ideal body weight is, multiply it by 0.36, and that's how much protein you should get every day.
Awesome. So previously you've stated that really no supplements are necessary beyond B12, vitamin D, depending on kind of what your exposure to sun might be.
Right.
But in light of your research for this book, are there any nice-to-have supplements that you would get if you want to spend some extra money to promote health and longevity?
Yeah, well, I went into this book thinking I'd have a whole long list. So I went in thinking, oh, resveratrol might be one. Vitamin D might be one. I have a video talking about how vitamin D in randomized controlled trials decreases all-cause mortality. Boom, right there. So vitamin D supplementation, these NAD boosters, I'm sure one of them would work out in the end. So I thought I'd like have a whole, I thought that would be like part of the anti-aging eight, right? But no, shot down one after the other. And same thing with rapamycin, metformin, some of these drugs that people are using for anti-aging. Not worth the benefit, testosterone, all sorts of supplementation. And I was hoping to find something. So resveratrol triples the loss of brain tissue in terms of shrinking your brain. These NAD boosters, you know, are either not shown to be safe and not efficacious or neither safe or efficacious. But there's natural ways to boost NAD. So part of the anti-aging eight is boosting NAD, but not with the precursors. Our body's evidently way too smart to allow this blunt incursion of precursors to actually affect tissue levels. But there are things that I basically kind of take as supplements, like this papali stuff, like the long pepper. I don't really like the flavor. It has kind of this Szechuan white pepper kind of numbing taste that I don't care for. I put in these little edible film. I don't know if you've... Oh, this is probably like a weightlifter thing. So maybe you've heard about this. Where they have these little sheets of edible film. It's just one ingredient, potato starch. It's just like transparent. You see it. And you like put powders, weird powders in it, you know, whatever. Like, I don't know why. So like powders that probably don't taste good. So most people just, I guess, put it in a shaker bottle or something. But yeah, it's just like a way to take a whole bunch of stuff. So you can buy like supplements in bulk, right? Bulk powder is probably way cheaper than getting them in capsules. And then you just put a little, you know, whatever. Okay. So I heard about it from like the, you know, kind of sports literature. I was like, shit, I could do that. Cause otherwise it's like, I don't want everything to taste like turmeric. Like I don't want to like, I don't want to have like curry oatmeal. This is bullshit. Right. So, So I got those and I love them. And so I do a mix of, so it's like, I'm taking supplements, but not, they're just whole food spices. It's one part turmeric, one part amla, this dried Indian gooseberry powder, one part black cumin, and one part papali. And you can take a teaspoon of that. So you get a quarter teaspoon of each, a teaspoon of that in the edible film, and you just like wrap it up like a little wonton, dip it in water, and it just forms this like, and it looks really big, and you're like, wait a second, I couldn't, the reason you can't swallow a pill that big is because pills are hard, right? But this is just like a squishy little like mass, and it just goes down really easy. And yeah, so that's like my, you know, yeah, so, they're kind of like supplements, but it's not really a supplement per se.
Yeah, I call that like food as supplements.
Yeah, just food as supplements.
That,
there you go.
That you take.
Right. Because otherwise,
that
it's
you
like,
wouldn't normally want to eat, but yeah, you eat it for the
some
health.
Some people,
coverage.
I was just with some cool influence. Oh, what's the guy's name? I feel bad. Okay, so now I can't say his name because then I forgot his name. But well, I guess he'll know anyway. Anyway, I was just talking to him yesterday, and he has what he calls his death drink, which is like a little shot glass, and he puts the turmeric and all that, like nasty, everything nasty, and just takes it down and like gets it over with for the day. And it's like, wow, you're a stronger man than I. That sounds nasty. So yeah, I just do it in this stuff.
Yeah, I guess the death drink name
lives
up to
his
name.
Yeah, with a name like death drink, come on. I'm generally opposed to death drinks. It's kind of by,
So you mentioned resveratrol. We can make one quick note about red wine. Not all that it's cracked up to be.
Well, great. So eat some grapes. I mean, there's some stuff in the grape skins that's beneficial, like aromatase inhibitors and all sorts of good stuff. But get in grapes, or even better, seeded grapes. And the problem with it, if you're going to drink red wine, have it de-alcoholized red wine, because the alcohol is metabolized into a carcinogen, known carcinogen called acetaldehyde, increases risk even at light levels of drinking. There's really no safe level of drinking, which is what we're realizing now. We used to think that, we always knew that heavy drinking, binge drinking, drinking during pregnancy, bad. But we had this idea that light to moderate drinking was actually beneficial. Light to moderate drinkers lived longer than the abstainers, than the teetotalers. And so there's actually some benefit, maybe heart benefit, whatever it was. Turns out that was an artifact of misclassifying systemically former drinkers as lifelong abstainers. And so the reason someone's not drinking is because they got liver cirrhosis, they had some horrible thing. So no wonder they don't do very well. And when you actually just look at actual people that don't drink, not you know, since last Tuesday because of some horrible problem, then the so-called J curve disappears in a straight linear increase in disease risk. And so World Heart Federation, World Health Organization, global burden disease study, only safe intake is zero, as with any carcinogen, right? And if you can avoid, you know, it's like, you know, something like mercury, lead, it's like only safe intake is zero. Now that doesn't mean it's possible. In our world, it's impossible to not consume lead, not consume mercury, not consume, God knows, this long list of horrible things, but we can try to minimize our risk.
Yeah. Great. So I know that the Daily Dozen has been the foundation of your diet for years. I wanted to ask you if there has been any changes to your diet since you began researching how not to age. You already listed everything
bunch.
That I knew about.
Yeah, is I think that's, else? Yeah, so the papale, the strawberries, the wheat germ, the tempeh, eating more mushrooms. I think those have been the kind of the big things that kind of changed my day-to-day.
Great. All right, well, I'd love to finish this interview with a quick lightning round of questions.
So let's do it.
I'd love to just hear your brief take on the following questions.
Boom.
So what are your top three veggies?
Oh,
top three favorites.
Purple sweet potatoes. I got some in my bag. I can show you. Purple sweet potatoes, right? 70% of the caloric intake, 69% of the caloric intake of Okinawan Japanese when they had this incredible centenarian rate, they were centered around these wonderful sweet potatoes. Anyway. And then arugula, nice cruciferous green. Boom. And then, if I had to go to number three, oh, man, so much good stuff. Oh, God damn it. Probably another cruciferous, but I'm trying to think.
Broccoli's going to feel left out on your
shirt.
Yeah,
I know, but I already got a cruciferous, so I don't want to like.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a non-cruciferous. What else am I eating? Yeah, all right. Yeah, it's probably broccoli. Okay.
Yeah, all right, it feels a little sad, I think, but.
Yeah. All right, so, yeah.
What about top three favorite fruits?
Ooh, oh, I love mangoes. I was so sad about that. It was some bad mango study in the skin chapter or something. I was just like, God damn it. Anyway, but look, I may have my biases, but you got the science is the science. So, yeah, I love mangoes, love pomegranates. It's pomegranate season right now. Ooh, amazing. I always look forward to both mango season and pomegranate season as soon as they start. And I'm always eating really bad ones for a while because it's like early in the season, but I'm like, I'm so happy to have them back. And then if I had to pick third, I'm a big fan of sweet tango apples.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if you those haven't had sweet tangos, and you got to get them in season, but yeah, good stuff.
I've been on a Cosmic Crisp apple.
Oh, yeah, not
run
bad.
Lately.
Not bad. Yeah.
What's your current stance on omega-3 supplementation to get preformed EPA and DHA? Should you actually supplement? If so, who should do that?
Yeah, so pollutant-free EPA, DHA. So from an algae source. It used to be a yeast source, but I don't think that's on the market anymore. And so I think people should consider 250 milligrams of algae-based pollutant-free DHA every day for cognitive health, particularly older men.
Okay, great. What's your favorite thing to do outside of work? I know you work a lot.
Work, more work.
Research?
No, I'm a big proponent of effective altruism. So philanthropy, because I have all this book money coming in. And so I spend a lot of time like wanting to find the most impactful ways to make the world a better place. And so, this is basically work and then philanthropy.
Yeah, love that. So as you mentioned, your next book that's coming out is on cancer.
Cancer.
Do you know how many books will ultimately make up your How Not To series?
Oh, I presume I'll fit them all into that kind of mold. The next one after that is on mental illness, right? So, and that, I don't know, there's not really a How Not To in there, right?
Yeah.
It's like How Not To Cry? That doesn't work, right? So, I don't know what we're going to do with that. I mean, and the pandemic book was going to be How Not to Die in a Pandemic, but they thought that was just a little too harsh because it was like right during the pandemic. It's like, it's a little morose. So it's like How to Survive a Pandemic. So that's how it came out.
Yeah.
But it's becoming a bit of a stretch, but How Not to Die was such a great, I love how that came out. And actually I didn't come up with that title. Guy who ghost wrote The South Beach Diet came up with that title.
Very cool.
It's a great title.
I didn't know that.
If I can. So I presume the next one is going to be How Not to Die from Cancer.
So do you believe we'll see a vegan world in our lifespan? Predominantly vegan world.
Oh, predominantly. Yeah. Because we're never going to go all the way. I think that depends. I mean, it really depends on what people do, right? I mean, it depends on us. It depends on, there's a great, Martin Luther King Jr. quote, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. But it doesn't bend towards justice on its own. It bends towards justice because there's people in the streets. There are people working day in, day out who never go in the history books that make change happen. And so the reason we're seeing all sorts of amazing things right now, like the default plant-based hospital meals in New York City and like all these amazing things is because there's a lot of hard work. It's like healthy food in a hospital. That doesn't happen just on its own. There's all sorts of exciting things, happening afoot. It's just a matter of, whether we're going to, make the change we want to see.
Yeah. All right, last one, fun one to close it out. If PubMed had a ranking of their top users, what number do you think you'd be?
Well, I mean, it's internationally used. You know, it's really sad when the government shut down years ago. Remember, there was a government shutdown. PubMed disappeared. In fact, it was so devastating to the international science community that there were calls that, like, we have to take this out from the U.S. government. Like, we cannot rely on the U.S. government anymore to provide the service. So it's used by researchers all over the world. And so we need to have some kind of independent thing that can't just shut down. Like, that was devastating. It's used by everybody. So it's like, you know, no matter how much you Google, what's your ranking of how often you Google? Like, you're still like million down, even if you're like Googling all day long. So it's probably the same with PubMed, but I am on it all the time. It's my first bookmark, and it's the largest medical database in the world, thanks to the National Library of Medicine. In fact, that's why I moved to DC there's a bike trail that basically went from my house to the National Library of Medicine. And so that was before we had great internet. Everything was basically online. And so I actually had to go to the library, and they weren't open on weekends. And it was, now I can live anywhere. I can be on some, I can live on some island somewhere and, you know, with my feet up, you know, and good Wi-Fi, and I can rock and roll.
Working on the next book. Awesome. Well, I so appreciate your time. Thank you for taking the time for this. There are so many questions I chopped out of this interview that I wanted to ask you.
Next time.
So packed with incredible information. So I want to thank you for your time. The work that you and your team do at nutritionfacts.org is truly extraordinary. I really appreciate everything that you do. And for everyone who is watching, How Not to Age is out now. This is one of the best books on health and diet that I've ever read, and it's also a really enjoyable read. Plus, Dr. Greger very generously donates 100% of proceeds to charity. So you can click the link in the description to learn more about How Not to Age, order your copy, and just wanted to say I really appreciate your time. Thank you so
much. Thanks, Life. Awesome.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Vegan Gym Podcast with Dr. Greger. His latest book, How Not to Age, is out now and available at Amazon and all other major retailers. This book is really amazing, so please be sure to grab a copy. You're going to learn a ton, and you can also support Dr. Greger and his amazing work at nutritionfacts.org. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to catching you on the next episode.